Good morning, everyone, wherever you are across the country. We hope you are warm and safe and not in a blizzard as we were yesterday in Chicago. Happy to welcome our guests. I do want to say this is the final breakout session presentation that was to have been provided now 1 year ago at our in-person clinical summit that was to have been in Nevada. So we appreciate the patience of this group in hanging in there with us. And I think you're in for a great morning around a paradigm shift for weight management in pediatrics and adults. I do want to acknowledge Dr. Balasubramanian from Baylor College of Medicine. And he was instrumental in pulling this panel together with Dr. John Flynn, who is our physician leader and senior vice president for operations at Baylor and the Baylor St. Luke's Medical Group for the physician enterprise. So I'm going to do some brief introductions, and I actually want to start with Dr. Flynn, who may not have had a formal introduction before. John has now been with the Physician Enterprise for a year. He's done a great job. He grew up, I guess I would say, from a medical standpoint at Johns Hopkins. After being at the University of Missouri Columbia in Columbia for medical school, he did his internship and residency at Johns Hopkins, his fellowship in clinical rheumatology at Johns Hopkins, and also a master's in business at Johns Hopkins. I mentioned that he is the senior vice president for the Physician Enterprise of in the Texas division. Prior to his joining us a year ago, he was a professor in the Department of Medicine at the University of Chicago, chief physician of the Chicago Health System, Dean for Clinical Affairs, and head of the faculty practice plan, president of the University of Chicago Medicine Care Network, and medical director for the University of Chicago Health Plan. He's had several appointments, including a professor in the Division of Rheumatology and chief medical officer of the Accountable Care Organization. I remember well interviewing Dr. Flynn when he came, and I said, "You're the person with the killer CV." It was very impressive. And then let me introduce our three panelists. Dr. Young Choi, who attended, he's from Houston, grew up in Houston, attended the United States Military Academy at West Point. He served in the Army for 21 years as a surgeon. He did a fellowship in minimally invasive surgery at the Baylor College of Medicine, is currently chief medical officer at the St. Luke's Woodlands Hospital, along with being a surgeon treating patients for bariatric care and reflux. Dr. Stephanie Sisley is an assistant professor at the Baylor College of Medicine in the Division of Nutrition and Pediatric Endocrinology. She trained at the University of Notre Dame, Indiana University, Riley Children's Hospital, and Cincinnati Children's Hospital Medical Center. She's currently a pediatric endocrinologist and the director of the genetic disorders of the obesity program at Texas Children. And last but not least, Dr. Leila Abushamat is an endocrinologist in the section of cardiovascular research at the Baylor College of Medicine. She received a bachelor's degree in biochemistry and cell biology at Rice University, her medical degree and master's of public health from Tulane. She did her internal medicine residency at the University of Florida and an endocrinology fellowship at the University of Colorado. Her clinical and research focus is cardiometabolic disease, specifically metabolic syndrome, obesity, lipoidology. Do I have that right? Lipoidology. And cardiovascular disease prevention. So I think we're in for a great morning. And we, again, want to thank all of our panelists and John for being here. Brooke is on and John Kanishi is on. Dr. Sagar may be joining us late, but I think we should get started. So I think, Dr. Abushamat, we're starting with you. Is that right?
Actually, no.
Oh, Oh, I'm sorry. Who are we starting with? Oh, Stephanie. Okay, there we go. Yes. Okay, sorry. There we go.
No problem. All right. Well, thank you so much for having me. It's really a treat to be able to share this with you. So we're just going to start with a small case, a 9-year-old girl. So she presents to your clinic with complaints of weight gain. She and her mother report that she's always been heavy, but that over the last 2 years, she has gained over 20 pounds per year. They have noticed some darkening of the skin on her neck. Her weight has recently stabilized, and after reducing some of her daily intake of soda and processed snacks. Review of the systems is negative, except for intermittent headaches. She gets about one per month. Typically, they're after school. She denies hirsutism, worsening acne, muscle weakness, headaches that are severe in the morning, constipation, or cold intolerance. Her family history is significant for obesity in her mother, a 12-year-old sister, and maternal grandfather. And maternal aunt had bariatric surgery. Her father has normal weight and no medical problems. Her 8-year-old brother has ADHD and has normal weight. There is no history of consanguinity, pregnancy losses, or other disorders in the family. She was born at term after a pregnancy complicated by gestational diabetes. She has intermittent asthma that does not require daily medical therapy. She has not had menarche, and she is receiving no medications currently, but she has required oral glucocorticoid therapy in the past for acute asthma exacerbations. And a review of her medical chart, which I'll show you in just a moment, shows her BMI was at the 126th percentile of the 95th percentile at age 4, and she has tracked between 140th and 160th percent of the 95th for most of her life. And her height has been consistently between the 95th and 99th. So here's her actual growth charts. This is her length. You can see that she has been growing extremely well. She's been growing above the chart. Now, for those of you who don't treat pediatrics, this is really common in children who have obesity, that they will kind of be taller than you would maybe expect earlier on. They tend to start plateauing a little bit sooner. You can kind of see that in her a little bit. So they kind of tend to actually be more towards what you'd predict and not actually above the chart. Now, regarding her BMI, in pediatrics, the way we actually define classes of obesity is actually based on, it's very odd wording, but this is charts that came out a couple years ago. And so basically, this is a percent of the 95th percentile, which if you want to simplify it a little bit, it's like if 120th percent of the 95th is considered severe obesity. So everything on this line is 1.2 times whatever the 95th percentile BMI would be at that age. So she has had severe obesity since age 2. And it has continued her whole life. So what else should be considered? So obesity is really complicated, and there were new guidelines that were published by the American Association of Pediatrics just a few weeks ago. And one of the things, if you actually read the entire guidelines, which is like over 100 pages, you will see that this is what they stress. It's really complicated, and there's a lot that goes into it, which is probably why it's really hard to treat. So what else should we consider? Clearly diet, making sure that, you know, she's eating healthy foods. How much heavily processed foods are they eating? There's pretty good data that the more processed foods you eat, the heavier your weight probably is. And so there's something about the processed foods that is probably contributing to weight gain. She's already decrease her sugar sweetened beverages, but there could be other things in her diet that are contributing. Energy expenditure. I see a lot of kids, and there are many that I feel like they really have an energy expenditure issue. Their diet really isn't that different from maybe what my kid's diet is. They just don't seem to burn energy. Unfortunately, there's really no way of testing this well. So you can't, it's not really easy to be able to get a really good marker of their true energy expenditure. And unfortunately, we can't treat energy expenditure in and of itself right now. But it's certainly, you know, something to consider whether or not there seems to be more of an energy phenotype. Social determinants of health, you know, whether or not the family is suffering from food insecurity or other aspects that are going to cause stress in their life and potentially make it harder for them to implement the changes that you would be requesting. Sleep, we know that if you don't get good sleep, you will have resistance to hormones because of the circadian rhythms being off. And so making sure that from a comorbidity standpoint, there's not obstructive sleep apnea that can lead to other cardiovascular issues, but just sleep in general, that the sleep is good, that it's on a good rhythm, to make sure that hopefully their body is functioning as metabolically normal as possible. Stress, and with that, mental health. So stress, we know, can contribute. So especially long-term kind of chronic stress can raise kind of cortisol levels, which could contribute to weight gain. Mental health, depression and anxiety, again, can contribute to weight gain, as well as the medications that are required to treat these disorders can sometimes contribute to weight gain. So medication. So I had mentioned in the case that she has asthma. She is not on a daily controller medication. One of the questions to really ask, especially in kids who have asthma, is whether or not, how many rounds of glucocorticoids have they been given? And I actually just saw a kid last week who the weight gain really started after she was essentially taken to the emergency room. In basically almost a like cardiac arrest because of the asthma exacerbation. And she had multiple rounds of glucocorticoids, which clearly can contribute to weight gain. There are cultural aspects. And I think, you know, the aspect of the cultural piece of it really needs to be considered, especially as you give recommendations, as well as, you know, in pediatrics, a lot of times the family is also an integral part of taking care of the child. So grandmas or aunts, and sometimes that piece of it can be really frustrating for the parents because they're trying to implement things and then the child will go to a family member's house and that the family member feels like, oh no, the kid is fine. So there's definitely cultural aspects and making sure that our recommendations actually fit with what they culturally do so that we're not recommending something that they would never eat or never do, or is just not something that they would agree with. Hormonal causes. So a lot of people are really concerned, especially parents, that this is a thyroid issue or that they have Cushing's disease. So her growth chart rules out Cushing's or hypothyroidism as a longstanding issue. In kids that are growing, if you have Cushing's or thyroid, your growth is going to completely plateau. And she has been growing above the 95th percentile. So you can rule that out without any testing. For environment, there's really no tests for this, but you know, clearly asking if there's potentially things in the environment that might be contributing. Anything that's going on in the brain can contribute. And then genetic causes. So for this child, actually, she has a really strong family history. Her mom, her sibling, her grandfather all have obesity. And she has an aunt that's actually had obesity that's severe enough to have bariatric surgery. So there's a strong genetic link. And we know that there are definitely genetic forms of obesity, melanocortin 4 receptor deficiencies being the most common. causes, but leptin and leptin receptor and a whole bunch of others. So when I see a strong family history, I think of potentially a monogenic form and would want to either perform genetic testing myself or refer to genetics. She did not have any symptoms or signs of syndromic causes, but definitely for children who have developmental or other organ issues, you'd want to think about a potential syndromic cause of obesity. I won't go through this whole thing. The new obesity new guidelines from the AAP have a really nice appendix that kind of walk you through the comorbidity. But if this is the first time you're seeing the child, you'd want to do some screening for comorbidities. In general, that's going to be a lipid, an ALT, and an A1C. Now, I will say that the actual AAP recommendations say to not do screening until age 10, and she was not 10. But in my kids who have severe obesity, I actually do do screening before then. If it's normal, you're going to repeat it. And if it's abnormal, then you will either treat it or continue to follow. At every visit, you want to screen for blood pressure, do sleep histories, make sure that there's no orthopedic increased intracranial hypertension. And then depression, this is going to be based on your comfort level as far as what to do with it if you feel like the child does have depression. So what treatment options would you offer? The recommendation is clearly going to be intensive health behavior and lifestyle. So the best thing that we can do is definitely make sure that we're doing and giving them guidance on behavior and lifestyle changes. The thing that is going to be the most effective is currently 26 or more hours, essentially over 3 to 12 months. This is extremely hard to do. Hopefully some of you have access to programs where you can refer children to get this type of help, but this is hard to do. And so hopefully over time, we'll maybe have some things that you may have to actually, in order to kind of put this together, you might have to actually refer patients to different providers or different, you know, whether it's a dietitian, as well as, you know, some other program, as well as, you know, physical therapy or something to kind of get pieces of the puzzle together if you don't have this in your office. But what if the patient was 13? Which option would you choose? Do we have a polling option? Here we go. Mm-hmm. So if the patient was 13, would you choose a 6-month trial of lifestyle, offer an approved pharmacotherapy option, offer a referral to bariatric surgery, give resources and see the patient back in 3 months, or refer to a dietitian and return in 3 months? So hopefully our answers are in. And almost half of you said to do 6-month trial of lifestyle. A few of you thought to pursue a medication or to refer to a dietitian and see back. I think, I mean, technically there is no wrong answer here. I think what is surprising people with the new AAP recommendations is that they said pharmacotherapy should be offered to all patients who have obesity if they are 12 years of age and older. Doesn't mean you have to give it, but at least to just bring it into the discussion. And what was interesting is they didn't say after 6 months of lifestyle failure, which had been kind of the recommendation before, is if you had severe obesity and you had failed, maybe you should bring it on. And I think part of this is because we actually have some medications that are more efficacious, as well as we have not been moving the needle at all in pediatric obesity. And so clearly continuing to rely only on lifestyle seems to not be helping us. The other piece of the puzzle, I think, is also that there's a lot of really good data that once you develop obesity, there's a lot of different things in the body that do not work well, like it is not metabolically working the way it's supposed to. And so the only way to really get at that in some cases is going to be through therapies. Now, Dr. Boshamat will cover a few of these as well, but this is actually just to show you a comparison of the main clinical trial data for the currently approved drugs in adults, the ones with asterisks are currently approved in pediatrics. So the solid bars are the adult data and the hash bars are the peds data. And what you can see is that in general, the medication that is currently approved that provides the kind of best weight loss is going to be semaglutide, the subcutaneous form. Next would be Qsymia. And both of these, the pediatric and adult data is pretty close. I will just note for the pediatricians, liraglutide, actually the pediatric data is not nearly as good as the adult data. And no one really has understood this, but liraglutide doesn't have nearly the effectiveness in pediatrics. Now, you can argue that weight loss in kids is maybe not the best thing to look at because, you know, what happened to the placebo group if they gained weight? And so that is the case. In many of these placebo groups, they actually did gain weight. And so when you look at the relative amounts of weight loss, it is better than the absolute values. I do want to just point out metformin because the AAP guidelines mention metformin. Metformin is a horrible weight loss drug. It really does very, very little. So maybe if you have someone who is just over the 95th and needs to lose just a few pounds, but it's not approved for obesity. And so it's really not a great drug. Where metformin might be helpful is if you think there's true insulin resistance or if the child is on an antipsychotic medication, there's some data that metformin can actually help curb the weight gain from those medications. And then if you're just looking at overall effectiveness in pediatrics, so semaglutide has over about a 72% effectiveness as far as reduce having a clinically meaningful weight loss. And you can actually see that 50% of kids actually had a BMI reduction of 15% or more. For adults, tirzepatide has the most, but it's currently not FDA approved for obesity. But again, kind of the same type of pattern. And so where are these drugs working? Why do they work? They work in the brain. Tirzepatide is actually causing activation of two different receptors, but you can see that all the GLP-1s, they're acting in different parts of the brain. So they're hitting different areas of the brain, which is probably why some of these drugs are a little bit more efficacious than others, because they're not acting just in one part, but in multiple parts. And the other thing to note is that bariatric surgery can be offered. So this child was 13. So if the child, or so if the child had been 13, the recommendations are also to offer or at least bring up bariatric surgery as well. And this is again adult and pediatric data showing that for bariatric surgery, adults and adolescents have very similar effects. And I will stop there.
Great. We're gonna hold questions until we finish all three speakers, but that was excellent. Thank you so much. Okay.
So I will take over to discuss weight management in adulthood. And so thanks, Dr. Sisley, for a great overview. A lot of what we discussed in pediatrics will be true also in adulthood. We'll also start with a case here. We have a 60-year-old female who presents due to unsuccessful attempts at losing weight over the last year. Medical history includes hypertension, hyperlipidemia, obstructive sleep apnea, prediabetes, depression, and osteoarthritis. So very common other comorbidities. She is on medications for some of her comorbidities as listed here. As far as her social history, since COVID, she's been working from home as a marketing specialist. She lives with her husband, who's also overweight and resistant to her attempts at lifestyle change, but she denies a history of tobacco use. She does note some social alcohol use and otherwise denies illicit drug use. Her surgical history includes wisdom tooth extraction and then laparoscopic cholecystectomy in her 40s. And she does have a family history of a mother with diabetes, obesity, and thyroid disease, and father with hyperlipidemia and coronary artery disease at age 70. As far as her physical exam, it is notable for a BMI of 29. And then when you ask her about her weight history, so weight history is we ask at different points in people's life to try to see the trajectory in their adult life. In general, everyone will have an upward trajectory over the course of their adult life. Some high points that we typically ask about are high school. In high school, she weighed 130 pounds. When she got married, she was about 145 pounds at around age 23. At her first child, she gained 10 pounds to 155. And by the time she had her second child, she gained an additional 10 pounds to 165. She lost about 10 pounds over the next few years. But then after the age of 35, has been slowly gaining weight and gained an additional 10 pounds within the last 10 years since menopause. So first, kind of discussing definitions and scope. And many of you know this, and there is a lot of controversy about this. Our most recent guidelines for obesity are from 2014. And at that time, we still defined obesity by body mass index, and we still do, with body mass index being weight in kilograms over height in meters squared. It's found on any calculator online, and several patients are able to access this as well. With anything between a BMI of 25 to 29.9, being overweight, and we have about a 31.1% of people in the United States fitting that category. Anything over 30 is considered obese, and we have about 42.5% prevalence in the U.S. of obesity. So in total, about 74% of people are overweight or obese in the United States, as of the most recent statistics. And the reason there's a little bit of controversy here is it is a population-based definition. Some people prefer to use waist circumference. There aren't any really cutoffs or targets in for waist circumference currently per the guidelines. And the reason being is that body mass index can vary by age, sex, and particularly by race and ethnicity. And then it's important to note these because anti-obesity medications are indicated based on BMI. And so when you have a BMI over 27 with a weight-related comorbidity, an anti-obesity medication is indicated, or having a BMI over 30. So we'll have an audience polling question here. What would be the next best step for this patient? And it should be popping up here. Again, this is a very common scenario. Many people you know in your life may fit this scenario. And so we'll give just a moment here, but we have A, assess for medical cause of weight gain or resistance to weight loss, B, lifestyle counseling, or C, offer anti-obesity medication. And in a way, this is somewhat of a trick question because all answers are probably in some portion correct, but everyone here noted A, and that is the answer I have here. And we'll talk about each of these as we go through. But when I say assess for medical causes of weight gain or resistance to weight loss, a lot of these were mentioned and covered by Dr. Sicily, including these primary causes and the genetic causes. But whenever people are in adulthood, you really want to start focusing again on these secondary causes. We do get a TSH for most people. Cushing syndrome, you don't really necessarily have to get laboratory workup. It can be just from physical exam, whether or not you have a higher clinical suspicion, then you would proceed to a workup. But I do want to stress here, just evaluating for depression or eating disorders. There is a lot of weight stigma, but also there may be a trigger for the patient to discuss weight or diets. And so that's something that you do need to kind of discuss with the patient up front. In this case, this patient had presented specifically asking about weight loss. And then I wanted to bring attention to some of the drug induced, because some of these are very common in our patients, particularly beta blockers. So something just to keep in mind is to assess the medication list for other potential contributors to weight gain. So another polling question here, what amount of weight loss should be recommended to her? Would you recommend about 10 pounds, which is about 5%, 20 pounds, which is about 10%, 25, or 30? All right, so let's see what everyone recommended. Everyone said about 20 pounds. And again, there isn't necessarily a wrong answer here, but it is something, it's a great point to discuss with the patient to assess their goals. Oftentimes, patients want extreme weight loss. They're looking to lose 40 pounds, be their high school weight. But really the stress here is we're trying to lose weight to improve comorbidities, but also future cardiovascular disease risk, which is determined by your cardiovascular risk, which a lot of these comorbidities cover. And you can get benefit at just 2.5% weight loss. And that's something a lot of patients don't realize. You know, so in studies, we've seen diabetes prevention and those with insulin or impaired glucose tolerance with a 2.5% weight loss, improve blood sugars and triglycerides, improve fertility in people with PCOS. For those suffering from osteoarthritis, you see improvement in knee pain at just 5%, fatty liver improvement at just 5%, as well as improvement in depression, mobility, sexual function, and decrease in hospitalization costs. At 10%, we start to see improvements in sleep apnea, which this patient does have sleep apnea, and then improvement in CV outcomes. And then lastly, at over 15%, you start to see improvements in all cause and cardiovascular mortality. In this patient, since she does have sleep apnea, it would be something to consider going to about 10%, but you can make smaller goals with the patient to ensure that she is able to meet the goals and then change goals as you move forward. And then next, what is the next best step? So in this case, many of you have already kind of offered this, but I'll go ahead and see what everyone says here. Go ahead and end the poll. So many said offer anti-obesity medications, and we'll discuss that in just a little bit here, but lifestyle counseling is still the next best step. And we do have evidence-based lifestyle interventions. Many of these are based off of the diabetes prevention program. The three components that every evidence-based lifestyle intervention should include is diet, physical activity, and behavioral change. With diet, there really is no diet that has been proven to be best for weight loss. And the key here is going to be calorie restriction and adherence, regardless of whether it's low fat, low carb, intermittent fasting. Many patients may come to you asking for the optimal diet. And really, you need to fit the diet within what they're most able to adhere to. And that's where maybe cultural factors come into play as well. Physical activity, the recommendation is over 150 minutes per week. Oftentimes, that's very difficult to get to initially. There are a lot of barriers to people with obesity, with physical activity. We mentioned just with 5% weight loss, you can have improvement in knee pain. So as patients continue to lose weight, this may be more of a goal that they can achieve. So you can set a smaller goal early on. And lastly, behavioral change. It's really, there's a lot of evidence behind self-monitoring of food intake, physical activity, and weight, not just for weight loss, but also for weight maintenance. And as with pediatrics, the best evidence for a 5 to 10% weight loss with a lifestyle intervention is face-to-face sessions, not virtual sessions, not telephone sessions, but face-to-face, about 1 to 2 times a month. And Several of these are commercially offered. You do want to look for one potentially that is similar to what was offered in diabetes prevention program. And there are several in the different communities that you can look up to recommend patients to if you don't offer one at your clinic. As far as anti-obesity medications, I love that many of you mentioned that because it is an adjunct to lifestyle therapy and should be offered upfront for these patients. It's something that is a tool to help navigate the environment that we are in, that's an obesogenic environment. And Dr. Sisley went through many of these medications here. There are many that are currently approved for obesity, except for here, tirzepatide, which is actually the one that offers one of the most efficacy for weight loss. And here I've included bariatric surgery. Dr. Choi is going to go over that in just a little bit here. And then you can see here, diet and exercise is at the top. But really the stress here is that it's lifelong treatment. Obesity is a chronic disease. Once a patient starts on a medication, ideally they would continue this just like with blood pressure. When you start a medication, you get to a normal blood pressure, you continue your blood pressure medication to maintain that normal blood pressure. And with that too, you do want to assess whether or not they are tolerating the treatment and whether they are getting any weight loss with the treatment. And failure of treatment is defined as less than 5% weight loss at 3 months. And to select an agent, you really want to consider comorbidities, including things like diabetes, coexisting mood disorders, GI disorders. None of these are approved in pregnancy. And so you do want to ask about conception planning for patients who are reproductive age. And then lastly, there is a heterogeneous response to all of these medications. These are not magic bullets. Patients do get very differing responses. And I love this figure from an article, a review that was just published this month, showing the variable responses that patients see to different medications. And here you can see anything to the left of the dotted line is weight gain, anything to the right is weight loss. And lifestyle intervention and medications all have some patients that actually gain weight with these interventions. We look at the you know, overall weight loss with a lot of these, and that's the mean. The only ones that we see typically everyone has weight losses with surgery and endoscopic procedures, and Dr. Choi is going to go over those, but you can see there is wide variability in how people respond to medications. So another audience poll question here, how much weight regain is expected if anti-obesity medications are stopped? Would you expect 50%, 67%, 100%, or 110%? Give a moment here for that. All right, let's see what everyone thought. All right, so we have many that say 110%, about 42% of you, but we do have a little bit in other areas. And this answer, I think it's been talked a lot about in the media recently with everyone saying, if you stop Ozempic, you're going to be regaining all the weight and more. And so I did bring up here, semaglutide is actually the one that we have the most recent data for weight regain. And this is recently FDA approved for obesity at 2.4 milligrams sub-Q weekly. Brand name is Wegovy. You start at about 0.25 milligrams sub-Q each week and increase up titration to 2.4 milligrams over the course of several months. And like we mentioned, you know, here there is a variable response to weight loss with this medication, but we still do see about 35% of people have over 20% or over 20% weight loss with it. And then they actually extended this trial and did a whole year off treatment and when in their extension. And here you can see the lifestyle therapy versus the medication therapy. And patients regained about two-thirds of their weight. So they still maintained a 5% weight loss or 5 kilogram weight loss here. And so it isn't necessarily 100%. Patients typically gain about two-thirds or 67% of their weight after stopping based on this trial, and they don't necessarily gain more. What you should recommend to patients is that they implement healthy lifestyle, but again, to stop weight regain, you do want to continue those anti-obesity medications long-term. Now, what if our patient had diabetes? then tirzepatide is currently approved for diabetes. It has not yet been approved in obesity, but we do have the SURMOUNT-1 trial that came out showing that with tirzepatide maximum dose, you get about 21% weight loss on average. And here is that kind of spread. It's a dose-based response, and those who received 15 actually had the majority lost over 25%, you can see there. And it's fast-tracked for FDA approval for obesity after completion of SURMOUNT-2, which is set to be complete in April 2023. So we're hoping that this agent is actually approved for obesity later on this year. So we mentioned weight regain, and it is a big topic for a lot of patients, and it's actually probably the hardest part of losing weight is maintaining that weight loss. And so one of the things I already mentioned is continuing anti-obesity medications have started, but we do have data on people who are successful weight loss maintainers from the National Weight Control Registry, people who've lost about 33 kilograms on average and maintained it for 5 years. These are the most common features for that group of people. Firstly is high amount of physical activity, about over 1 hour per day, low calorie and low fat diet that's continued, a regular breakfast. Big one is consistent eating pattern, regular self-monitoring of weight, and then catching slips before they turn into larger regains. And so having patients include these as part of their lifestyle, it's a lifestyle change. It's something that they should integrate into their current life so that they can maintain it over the course of their life. But also now we have these anti-obesity medications that should be seen as tools. And with that, I'll pass it on to Dr. Choi to discuss surgical options.
All right, thank you very much. Let me share my screen. Thanks to all the panelists. And I think this is definitely a multidisciplinary disease and approach that we need. And that's why recently I think surgery has become so successful, and that we understand that it's not just one-time surgery, one follow-up and they're done, but it is a lifelong journey, as we tell our patients, on weight loss surgery. So we'll go with a quick little scenario. A 45-year-old female with history of sleeve gastrectomy 2 years ago. Prior to surgery, her weight was 260 pounds, her body and height was 5'7", body mass index 40.7. Initially had good weight loss, 70 pounds over the first year. However, over the past year, she regained about 35 pounds. She reports still monitoring her diet and exercising regularly. Patient has intermittent reflux symptoms with heart controlled with omeprazole. Past medical history, hypertension, sleep apnea, and laparoscopic sleeve gastrectomy and laparoscopic cholecystectomy. So indications for bariatric surgery, obviously everyone should try non-surgical options, diets, exercise, seeing their primary care physicians or endocrinologists and really trying all efforts at weight loss. But studies have shown, especially with diets and exercise, less than a 2% success rate long-term for successful weight loss. So indications, anybody with the body mass index of greater than 40 or anybody with the body mass index of greater than 35 with comorbidities. And I think that's already been kind of laid out. The common ones people talk about are hypertension and diabetes, we have sleep apnea, and all sorts of other comorbidities. And as seen in the Utah trial where they followed patients long-term, it showed that there's a significant all-cause reduction of mortality after weight loss surgery, successful weight loss surgery. So definitely something. And the difficulty is trying to get that message across, because across the country, only about 2% of the patients who really can benefit from some sort of weight loss intervention, whether it be surgery, medications, diet, exercise, actually, get that. They have to be well-educated and motivated, complete a psychology and nutrition consult clearance. And exercise is a big part of this. When we talk to our patients, we always tell them, don't worry about the weight loss. Just start an exercise regimen now so that it becomes a part of your life or after surgery. So it's a complex disease, as was already discussed. But I think one of the best things that came up with this recently is that it is now known as a disease. It's not just, hey, you failed because you don't have willpower. As when I was doing residency a long time ago, that's kind of what a lot of even surgeons viewed it as. But now I think we've all understand that there's an environmental factor, behavior factor, genetics factor, that all plays into the role of this complexity. And you know, talked to several endocrinologists in the past, and I don't think we still understand fully all the endocrine factors as why when patients have surgery and they lose, before they even lose that much weight, all of a sudden their blood pressure gets a lot better, their diabetes gets a lot better, and they have to modify those medications. So it is a very complex disease. And the outcomes of bariatric surgery, if you look at type 2 diabetes, 86% of patients are either resolved or improved of their diabetes. Hypertension, over 78%, obstructive sleep apnea, hyperlipidemia. This is just a few factors. But again, as I've mentioned, with all the literature coming out there about effects of obesity on patients who had COVID, and then you look at all the other all-cause reduction in mortality, definitely this is an area that if we can improve this, we can really improve long-term quality of life. Our patients get a survey and a year after surgery, and when they see what they felt their state of health was before surgery, what they felt their quality of life was before surgery, and then what it is after surgery, there's a significant difference in what they feel, their state of health and their quality of life, and it's much improved. And also talking about healthcare dollars, this is where you can really, you know, if you can prevent patients from getting vascular disease due to diabetes or other issues, that can be a huge saver down the line. So sleeve gastrectomy, this has now become the most commonly done surgery in the U.S. It's overtaken the gastric bypass a few years ago. It's done laparoscopically or robotically. And what it is you free up the stomach. The spleen usually lives there on the very top part of the fundus. And you free up the stomach on the greater curve. And you go about 5 centimeters from the pylorus. And then you use a stapling device. And you can resect about 75 to 80% of the stomach, creating a long sleeve and then the stomach is removed. There is now people doing this endoscopically, also through a scope and then doing plication. Success of sleeve gastrectomy. Success of weight loss surgery in general has been very good. We have really good 5-year and long-term success rate. But the way we deem success is losing 50% of their excess body weight. And so if you take how much your ideal body weight is, subtract that from how much you actually weigh, that's your excess body weight. If you lose 50% of that, then that's what success is deemed for weight loss surgery. And there's studies out there. You can look at various studies. I listed one there. But if you look at anywhere from 50 to 70% excess weight loss in 5 years for sleeve gastrectomy, even gastric bypass. And if you do a head-to-head with gastric bypass and sleeve, they're very similar. Some people will feel that gastric bypass has a little better long-term weight loss with less recidivism and also with diabetes. But there is failure rate, and failure rate across the country is about 15 to 30%. There's a lot of reasons for failure rate. There could be technical, but also patients are very smart. You know, and I tell them, no matter what we do, if they want to eat or if they want to drink, they can. So we really educate them on the diet portion piece of it. They can't drink Starbucks cappuccinos, high-calorie milkshakes, because then you're not going to lose the weight. As mentioned earlier, also exercise is a key component. We recommend they exercise 5 to 6 days a week, at least 45 minutes to an hour, getting cardio to really be successful. So let's go back to this scenario. This patient had pretty good weight loss, but then had weight regain, which can happen sometimes. So there's a poll question, now what? So we're going to bring the poll up and see kind of what is the next step. All right. In the interest of time, we can go ahead and close the poll and see what results we got. So nutrition consult, upper GI, those are very good answers. This is a little trick question in that, you know, kind of you do all of it. It all depends on which order you want to do it. But I agree that nutrition consult and upper GI would be the two things I first go to. So with a nutrition consult, we send them out, make sure that they understand what the portion size is. A lot of time as they get further out in surgery or they are kind of confused on eating. When I was a resident, we did a study and there was all the patients who had weight loss surgery, almost 100% said they would do it again. And almost 100% said no matter how much we educated them, they did not realize how significant their eating was going to change. So it is a significant And then there's other factors, right? If someone is cooking for their spouse, but then they're eating separately. I've had patients tell me they have to cook two meals or they don't want to go out to eat because of the portion size. So that is something that we really harp on. And so I encourage them to keep a diet log. You know, there's many times where when you look back and ask them how much have you ate, when they think about it, they don't think they ate that much. But then when they go away for 6 weeks and come back with the diet log, they realize, wow, you know, my calories had increased recently. And so diet log is important. Exercise log is important to make sure they exercise. Upper GI, I get all patients who have a sleeve gastrectomy, whether if it was from me or if I, if someone else had done the sleeve and they come back to me for revision, I get upper GI to ensure that anatomy wise, the pouch isn't too big. Pouch usually doesn't stretch. The term stretching of a pouch is a little misnomer. But what can happen is that if too much of the fundus is left or if there's too big of a pouch, they can also add to reflux. And then endocrine consult. We have an endocrinologist that we work with here. And I think it's really a hand in hand. And recently with literature, it's been shown that, you know, after you do weight loss surgery, if they have to go on medication, that's not a failure. I think in the past, surgeons have seen it as a failure. So they were really hesitant to put them back on that. But a lot of studies are being done recently that show that after weight loss surgery, if they do not lose the appropriate amount of weight, getting them to early consultation, the endocrine, to have them work with them on other avenues of weight loss to include medication. That's really been helpful. And we've kind of partnered with an endocrinologist and she's helped us a great deal on several patients to really get that extra 10 to 20% excess weight loss that they weren't getting. So an upper GI, quick little picture here. This is an old X-ray. The reason I know this is an old X-ray is most people do not leave drains anymore. This was when we used to leave drains. But if you look at this, this is kind of how what a sleeve looks like. You want a slightly larger fundus, like a little pouch, and then a very thin, narrow sleeve all the way down to the distal part of the stomach. So medical management after surgery, as I kind of talked about, you know, when you use weight loss medications after weight loss surgery, it's shown that it's actually halted weight regain. And then in many studies, it's actually increased weight loss. So some of it's off-label use, and I list some medications there. And I think Dr. Vishwamath and Dr. Sisley did a wonderful job kind of going over all the different types of medications. And that's where I think you really need to partner. As a surgeon, we really partner with either a weight loss specialist or endocrinologist and work as a team to help these patients. Revision to a gastric bypass, that's always an option for patients who've had failed gastric sleeve. Well, the gastric bypass is, and this was the most commonly done weight loss surgery procedure in the U.S. prior to about 2-3 years ago when the sleeve has overtaken it. But this is still done. Instead of removing the stomach, what you do is you make a small little 30cc pouch, and then you reach about 60 centimeters from the ligament of the trites, you resect the small intestine, and then you reroute it. It's called a Roux-en-Y because it kind of looks like a Y. Some people feel that this also has some better endocrine effects than a sleeve. Sleeve can have endocrine effects because of ghrelin that can live in the greater curve of the stomach that you remove that controls hunger. But not only does this help with weight loss after sleeve and then failure, but it can also help reflux, because sometimes with sleeve gastrectomies, because you're narrowing that outflow, you can increase reflux. And in this case, now you're diverting all the acid from the stomach down distally. And this from the anastomosis down to that jejunal duodenoscopy is about 100 centimeters. So it's not going to travel back upstream. So who's a candidate? This, you have to really select patients carefully. Patients who have failed weight loss, and you got to kind of know, did they fail because they're not following exercise or diet properly? Because those patients probably aren't going to be successful even if you do a revision to a gastric bypass. So before you select a revision, you really have to kind of narrow down why they failed and ensure they're on the proper path on diet and exercise. And then once you do that and they still can't lose the weight, after you've done upper GI, make sure on certain patients who have severe reflux disease, this is also an option. There's variable success, you know, anywhere from 5% to 30% of excess weight loss. Again, and that's due to just selecting these patients carefully because, you know, sleeve gastrectomy is a very good surgery. We have very good results. So if they failed, you got to figure out the reason why they failed. But in general, when you revise it to gastric bypass, there is some endocrine effects that also allow them to lose a little more weight. And I will stop at that. I know this is a topic we can talk for hours, all of us individually, and I appreciate the opportunity to be able to share some.
Thank you, Young, and thank you as well, Stephanie and Layla. Really a topic of remarkable development in a very short period of time, both on a medical basis and on a public health basis. Stephanie, just some questions have come in with regard to pediatrics. One is the cultural question, and you alluded to this in your presentation. There are some cultures that view health in their child in positive ways with being big, being heavy. How do you address those cultural perceptions?
Yeah, so I typically address it with metabolic data. So, you know, as far as an actual like baby, you know, we don't do comorbidity screening labs on a, you know, a one-year-old. So I don't necessarily address it directly in a really small child, other than just saying we're going to monitor this over time, right? And just trying to make sure that if the child really has certain things, like for instance, they're 1 year old and they're still waking up in the middle of the night and taking a bottle, like, yeah, that's a lot of calories. They shouldn't be doing that. So like some of the things like that I will address. But really, as they get older, I think the way to address it a little bit better is because I can't argue with culture, but I can show metabolic data. And so I can say, well, right now, your child has looks like their liver is being damaged by the excess fat that has gone into their liver and it's inflaming it, or it looks like the glucose levels aren't responding well. And so from that standpoint, a lot of times parents are like, oh, right. And so I then talk about, we need to get your child to a healthier weight in order to get the, you know, these metabolic changes to change. And so that's how I typically address it. I don't, you know, I certainly don't try to put them down for their cultural belief. You know, that's just how it is. And I think, like I said, I typically see that more with grandmas, that grandma like wants to feed the son, you know, the grandson three sandwiches, because you can't leave grandma's house hungry. You know, and so, but that's how I address it, is with the metabolic aspects.
Great. No, thank you. And then there's a question related to really, what are the appropriate ways to gauge success and achieve goal? Is it absolute weight loss number, or is it BMI target, or is it
right,
reduction of medications? How do you define success, both in pediatrics and adults? Stephanie, if you want to start, and Layla.
Yeah. And I think part of this comes to what Dr. Bushima had said, as far as what are the patient's goals, right? What does the patient want? Because that's success for the patient. So regarding what you monitor in kids, you absolutely monitor BMI. I showed a graph with weight loss just because the adult studies don't show BMI changes very well. And I will say, if you're trying to actually compare trial to trial to trial, it's really hard in obesity, because they report things very differently in each study. And so weight loss is one of the ways that was the easiest way to kind of just show the medications head to head as far as the different trials. But absolutely, I showed a graph with BMI, percentage of BMI loss, and the effectiveness of the medication. So in children, if you're looking at weight, you're definitely going to be monitoring BMI because they're growing. We don't look at weight in and of itself. But I think as far as what is success, a lot of times success is truthfully in kids, it's just weight maintenance, with which will start dropping the BMI, and it's changes in metabolic parameters, and it's changes, like Dr. Bushman said, like knee pain, back pain, ability to do sports, all those things are successes and wins, and we celebrate them big time in my clinic.
Yeah, I would echo that. Really, metabolic parameters, especially for me, I have a cardiometabolic clinic. And so the focus is really on improving cardiometabolic risk factors, but also outcomes. And so if I can improve their diabetes or get them to go into diabetes remission, which has happened with a lot of these medications, that's a fantastic win. Or even just having them feel more rested because they no longer have sleep apnea from weight loss. And so really not necessarily focusing on the number, but that the benefits that they do receive, especially since there is a lot of weight stigma for a lot of these patients.
Yeah, and John, I'll chime in there. I always try to steer them away from absolute weight and talk about it. And I always give them a story. I had a patient, you know, who had a family, her husband and their child, they would go on a hike up the hill every summer, and she couldn't go because she couldn't make that hike. It took all day. She waited at the bottom. They always went up and down. 1 year after weight loss surgery, she lost about 120 pounds. She felt great. Quality of life was better. And she made that hike for the first time. And she was so happy. And it's really those kind of stories. And that's what success is the quality of life, but also trying to maintain and not get sicker as you get older.
Great. Thank you. And a number of questions, you know, dealing with availability, insurance coverage, you know, public health issues. Gary, I don't know if you want to provide somewhat of a global oversight into that as well. But again, rapidly in changing environment. But Gary, please.
It is. And I just want to say that we haven't solved this, but it has definitely come up. And the way this works across the country is we have, and Greg, I think you're on our call somewhere, Greg Light from pharmacy, these PBMs, these pharmaceutical companies where, that we contract with to supply all of our medications, in this case for our employees, but all organizations use PBMs, whether you're General Electric or you know, some tech company or a grocery store, you all use PBMs. And it's the PBMs, I'm not picking on them, but they've excluded particularly semaglutide, which is very expensive, from their formulary. And honestly, it's probably, we're going to be speaking to those people. And I think the answer is going to be, well, if you want it, you'll have to pay for it, but we'll put it back on. And so we are actually taking an approach with both meeting with our pharmacy leadership and bringing this whole issue to the Ambulatory Pharmacy and Therapeutics Committee that we set up about a year and a half ago to sort of have some in-depth look at this. So I think the questions are real, they're valid. Layla and others have said, this is lifelong treatment, and it is expensive, at least it is right now. And so basically we're committing someone to pay for a lifelong of semi-glutatide, which I think is about $1,200 or $1,500 or $1,700 a month. Is that about right? Mm-hmm. So it's a big cost, and I agree we should pay for it, but I think we have to look at the reality. I mean, in a realistic way, like, is that really possible? Or so I just want to say that it is on our radar, and we're looking at it.
Now, I'll just mention one thing from a pediatric standpoint. Until this past year, there wasn't a drug that was effective in mm-hmm. more than half the patients. So liraglutide was the one that we had, and both liraglutide and Orlistat, they're only effective in 40 some percent or less. So it was a little bit hard to make the case that, hey, you need to pay for this, right? If it's really only going to be effective in 50%. I think now with Qsymia having better, and then now with semaglutide having, you know, 70%, you can make an argument that the medication itself, right, might actually be worth paying for. And so hopefully we'll see some change, but maybe that's just wishful thinking.
Right. And it is, and you know, we'll look at the downstream savings.
So thank you, Gary. And we're at time. I want to thank our panelists and really the emphasis you placed on, you know, this is a chronic condition. It is not solely related to lifestyle choices. And, you know, just as nearly 100 years ago, people with hypertension were told to modify their diet and lifestyle, it wasn't until at first diuretics came along, similar story with hyperlipidemia, and now with this. So thank you all.
Thank you. I just add my thanks. Thank you. And thanks to John and Brooke and our entire team for helping us put this on. And Dr. Flynn, excellent job. Thank you.